Hello, this is Kevin Anna of Eagle Strong Voice, and I'm speaking to you on behalf of the Republic News Network. It's March 8th, 2024. Well, Canada is well known for its murder of Indigenous people within its borders in order to make money for some corporation. And, of course, we've got a long history of this, the so-called Indian residential schools, the death camps that killed off over 60,000 children, resulted in no punishment at all for the churches and government responsible. So Canada and Christian Canada is an old hand at this kind of thing. But we don't have to look in the past for that. It happened again just this last year in a place called Melfort, Saskatchewan. And these are the people who suffered for it. 10 Cree people killed to get diamonds for a company called Rio Tinto, linked with the British Crown. From left to right at the top, Thomas Burns, Carol Burns, Gregory Burns, Lydia Gloria Burns, and Bonnie Goodvoice Burns. Bottom left to right, Lana Head, Christian Head, Robert Sanderson, Wesley Peterson, and Earl Burns Sr. The dateline, September 2022 to now. The location, the James Smith Cree Reservation near Melfort, Saskatchewan. Well, once upon a time, not too long ago, billions of dollars of diamonds were discovered under the homes of some Cree Indians in central Canada. But for some reason, the Cree didn't want their land torn apart by the Rio Tinto Mining Company, so their chiefs promptly told Rio Tinto to kiss their collective brown ass. At least they did at first. Then suddenly, the Cree chiefs found themselves the recipients of oodles of cash, new cars, and first-class luxury trips to Las Vegas and Hawaii, courtesy of, you guessed it, the Rio Tinto Mining Company, and its shareholders in the British Crown. Naturally, the Cree chiefs saw the light after that, and they all said yes to the destruction of their land. All of them did, except one. One man, he held out. His name is Chief Wally Burns, and he still said no to the bribes and to the mining. Well, the next thing Wally knew, six of his local Burns relatives were all murdered in one night, along with four other Cree. And then Wally dutifully fell in line with the other chiefs, and he withdrew his opposition to the mining. He was then rewarded with a higher position in the James Smith Band Council. But then some even stranger things started happening there at the James Smith Cree Reservation in eastern Saskatchewan. The three top Crown officials, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, Governor General Mary Simon, Anglican Archbishop Justin Welby, they quickly showed up at the obscure reservation. After dispensing the standard crocodile tears to the bereaved families of the victims, the three of them then doled out even more money to the chiefs, over $43 million. And the next day, lo and behold, some atypically efficient Mounties announced that they had caught the killer of the dead Cree Indians, a lone drifter and cocaine addict in very poor health named Miles Sanderson. Well, before anyone could say payoffs and cover-up, Miles quickly and conveniently died while in RCMP custody, like a latter-day Lee Harvey Oswald. And guess what? So did his alleged accomplice, his brother Damon, who was found dead the next day in a field. C'est l'absurd, n'est-ce pas? But it gets even worse, boys and girls. For guess who arrived next at the James Smith Cree Reservation? The one and only Clive Wieghill, the notorious ex-police chief of Saskatoon, who for years concealed the routine murder of Cree Indians by his city cops. But now Clive wore a new hat, that of the Crown Coroner, summoned to investigate the deaths of more murdered Cree. Well, you can guess what happened next. With the banal predictability of yet another stage-managed whitewash in which Canada excels, Clive and his Mountie buddies soon declared that Miles Sanderson was the lone killer. But they didn't bother to explain his motives or how he adeptly entered seven separate homes in one night and murdered 10 people while in a sickly condition and armed only with a knife. They also claimed that Miles had wounded 18 other Cree people with the same knife. Not bad for a feeble cocaine addict, eh? Well, to back up this absurd, unproven scenario, Clive Wieghill quickly convened a hand-picked coroner's jury, illegally stacked with only the right kind of natives, local band councillors and their friends, all of them on the government payroll. Naturally, the jury's prearranged verdict rubber-stamped the fairy tale issued by Clive Wieghill and his Mountie minions. The so-called Canadian media lapped up and regurgitated all this garbage and castigated the deceased Miles Sanderson as a heinous mass murderer. even though that had never been proven in a court of law. As with the Indian residential schools genocide, none of the reporters bothered to ask any obvious questions, like why Trudeau, Simon and Welby, and the Rio Tinto business associates doled out millions of bucks to the local chiefs, or why a media blackout was then imposed on everything right after Clive Wheekill's farcical pronouncement and jury stacking. Well, things went quiet after that for about a year, as the corporate wheels turned behind the expensive government smokescreen. To distance itself from its odious actions, Rio Tinto Company handed over its James Smith project to one of its affiliates, a company called Star Diamond, which is closely linked with the Chinese and their investors. Star Diamond then announced it would commence mining this month by March 2024 at the James Smith Cree site, calling it, quote, the world's largest undeveloped diamond mine. No wonder people had to die, huh? And so right on cue, early in January 2024, the feds and the RCMP began stage-managed public hearings into the James Smith massacre to make it seem that everything was all above board and peachy clean. Just like they did with equal duplicity in their infamous Truth and Reconciliation Commission that exonerated and decriminalized the church-led genocide of over 60,000 Indigenous children. And finally, during that same month of January 2024, the coroner and killer cop, Clive Wheekill, announced his official retirement. Out of sight, out of mind. But truth finds a way to seep through the cracks of even the most thorough criminal conspiracy, even in Canada. During 2023, evidence surfaced that King Charles himself was implicated in the James Smith Cree murders, a revelation that's been one of the factors that sparked his likely abdication behind an official cover story that he's sick with cancer. Well, he's a sick man, all right, but not because of cancer. Charles Mountbatten-Windsor likes to order the killing of Canadian Indians, especially those who threaten his Rio Tinto business interests and the image of his family. Just ask Major Johnny Thompson, Charles's top security advisor, at least he was until recently, when he started spilling the beans about his boss to his colleagues. Last fall, one of them gave his testimony to a citizens' tribunal in Vancouver, the West Coast Common Law Court of Justice. The court was convened on September 20th, 2023, to investigate the murder of Native activists in our movement, the movement to expose and prosecute Canada's homegrown genocide. Well, one of the activists killed was my friend William Coombs, and he was killed in St. Paul's Hospital on February 26, 2011, right after he went public with his eyewitness account of Queen Elizabeth and Philip abducting forever 10 children from the Kamloops death camp run by the Catholic Church back in October 1994. And, of course, turns out Charles was responsible for the kill order against William as well, as was proven uncontested in the common law court. According to the affidavit of Major Thompson's colleague who shared his remarks, a veteran member of the British Monarchy Security Force said, quote, in late December of 2010, I participated in a special operations meeting in Buckinghamshire. This meeting was called by Major Johnny Thompson, the King's chief security advisor, at the time Prince Charles's security advisor. Major Thompson told us he was appearing on behalf of Prince Charles. Charles, who had ordered him to arrange the elimination of a foreign assassin threatening the royal family. I was surprised when the target was a Canadian Red Indian, since normally the RCMP have jurisdiction over such operations. When I raised this with Major Thompson, he said, the Mounties will handle this one on the ground. We're just setting the wheels in motion. This is a royal directive. Well, I learned later that in early February 2011, Canada's RCMP commissioner, a Mr. Elliott, dispatched operatives to Vancouver to deal with the target in accordance with Prince Charles's order. I also learned later that the Indian they eliminated was a Mr. William Coombs, who as a homeless man seemed to be an unlikely terrorist. The whole affair troubled Major Thompson, who began to confide to us other disturbing actions by Prince Charles. Later, when we read Mr. Coombs' statement about his witnessing of the Queen's abduction of those children, some of us began to question our allegiances, unquote. Well, after this revelation was made public in the court's November 20th verdict that found Charles and others guilty of crimes against humanity, another source in England came forward with new evidence. It indicated that Charles had arranged the James Smith Cree killings in September 2022 to safeguard the Rio Tinto Star Diamond operation in which he had personal investments. Well, not coincidentally, the Cree killings took place just 4 days before Queen Elizabeth died, and Charles assumed the throne, inheriting Elizabeth's sizable personal fortune in Rio Tinto. Clearly, Charles wanted to safeguard his investment and all that money, and he did so with the help of the Church of England in the person of its top cleric, Archbishop of Canterbury Justin Welby, who quickly appeared at the scene of the crime in James Smith Cree Reservation. Now, of course, that's the same Justin Welby who was convicted by a common law court in 2014 for having arranged the destruction of documents and children's graves at his church's deadly Mohawk Indian Residential School in Brantford, Ontario. In a repeat performance, Archbishop Welby disposed of the remains of the murdered Cree Indians in Saskatchewan by having them buried in the local Anglican cemetery, safe and tucked away in case any honest forensic examiners started poking around. Apparently, Justin Welby was also the bagman of the $43 million payoff to the James Smith Cree chiefs. The James Smith Cree massacre is yet another Canadian tragedy. Tragedy become farce. When criminality is official and enthroned at the highest levels of society, it makes no effort to conceal itself. Even though this latest abomination in Saskatchewan is nothing new here in the Great White North, its actors have exhibited a desperation and clumsiness that reveals a deeper crisis. Royal rats are deserting the floundering ship called the British Crown as more insiders are breaking ranks and revealing new damning evidence against Charles and his family. As much as the other claimants to the imaginary British throne are exploiting Charles's woes for their own advantage, all the king's horses will not put them together again now that a majority of Canadians polled want an end to this criminal conspiracy called the British monarch. Many of these patriots are gathering this summer at a constitutional convention in Canada to lay the basis for a sovereign republic in this country, free of our legacy of genocide, tyranny, and corruption. As in early 2013, when one of our common law courts toppled a papal monarch called Pope Benedict and exposed more of the crimes of the Vatican, the deaths of the innocent are adding fuel to a growing fire. Let us fan those flames and finally put an end to the bloody triangle called big money, church, and state in Canada and beyond. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice for the Republic of Canada and the Republic News Network, republicofcanada.org, murderbydecree.com. Stand by for more.
Jesus was a working man and a hero, you will hear. Born in the town of Bethlehem at the turning of the year, at the turning of the year. When Jesus was a little lad, streets rang with his name.
A lecture by Kevin Annett given at Brock House in Vancouver, April 23rd, 2018. Hello, and thank you for giving me the chance to speak to you today here at Brock House. My name is Kevin Annett, and I'm a former clergyman in the United Church of Canada, as you may or may not know. For many years, I've led a public inquiry and then a global campaign to halt the genocide and trafficking of Indigenous children and children in general in Canada and abroad. This campaign did a number of important things, not only compelling Canada's official so-called apology for Indian residential school crimes in the summer of 2008, but 5 years later, it provoked the forced resignation of Pope Benedict from his office. Now, ironically, these historic achievements, along with my quarter century of work with Aboriginal survivors of the residential school genocide, it was all the result of a single terrible assault on me and my young family by a handful of officials of the United Church of Canada beginning on January 23, 1995. These men fired me without cause or due process and willfully destroyed my family, my livelihood, my good name and employability simply because when ministering in Port Alberni between 1992 and 95, I stumbled across and exposed their church's history of torture and murder of Aboriginal children in their local residential school. I also exposed their lucrative theft of Aboriginal land. On your invitation, I'm here today to tell you that story and to reflect on how easy it is for a modern, taxpayer-funded public institution like the United Church to destroy their opponents with impunity, conceal their crimes, and blacklist and annihilate anyone in their way. I know because I've lived through it. One of the reasons my good friend Dr. Jennifer Wade asked me to speak to all of you today on these hard matters is that she was an eyewitness to my public pillorying and fraudulent defrocking by the United Church between the years 1996 and 97, as well as to my convening of Canada's first independent tribunal into Indian residential school crimes in the summer of 1998 in Vancouver. That tribunal is too detailed a matter to address here today, but you can see all of the voluminous evidence about Canada's genocide that we gathered there on our website, murderbydecree.com. My subject today will be on what led to that tribunal, the astounding events of the illegal public show trial that posed as my defrocking from the United Church between August 1996 and March 1997, right here in Vancouver. Now, Bertrand Russell once said that the problem with bringing to light official secrets is not a lack of evidence, but the public's willingness to disbelieve. Indeed, the greatest protection enjoyed by criminals in high places is the refusal by the public to accept that they are guilty of malfeasance. Many mainstream Canadians cannot accept the fact that officially respected and protected leaders of church, state, and business have intergenerational blood on their hands and lies on their lips. I know firsthand this dilemma of disbelief, for I was raised and tutored within the same United Church of Canada that, along with the Catholics and the Anglicans, deliberately caused the death of more than 60,000 residential school children over a century. When I first encountered the living survivors of that homegrown genocide, and then the documentary records that confirmed their accounts, I couldn't believe that my church was responsible, that it concealed its crime and then used our money and misplaced faith and loyalty to it to deceive the public for many years, a deception that continues today. But as John Adams observed, facts are stubborn things, and the facts that I have so rigorously documented since 1995 bear continual and stubborn witness to a planned, systematic, and ongoing genocide on Canadian soil, carried out under the guise and the camouflage of religion, with the full knowledge and sanction of the government and the protection of Canadian law. As I mentioned, you can see the voluminous evidence of our domestic group crime for yourself on our website, murderbydecree.com, but also in my award-winning documentary film, Unrepentant, and in the 13 books I have written on this and related crimes of our until now hidden history. That evidence and truth has been secured through the suffering of many people, but its legacy has profoundly impacted our nation. It has, in fact, set in motion a revolution among us whose full meaning and outcome is not yet in sight. But that said, let me begin with a brief history. The events that led up to my professional and personal ruination and to my show trial from 1996 to 97 at the hands of the United Church officialdom all revolved around a massive historic theft by church and state here in the West Coast, the stealing of thousands of children's lives, of entire cultures, and of the resource-rich lands that the earliest missionaries in the British Crown grabbed from themselves. After being unanimously chosen as the new minister of St. Andrew's United Church in Port Alberni in the spring of 1992, and after beginning my work there that summer, I quickly encountered the human remains of a war of extermination led by our culture. That war wiped out over 90% of the ancient West Coast Indigenous tribes in barely two generations, primarily through the deliberate spreading of smallpox and tuberculosis by church missionaries. Danny Gus was the first Aboriginal man I ever visited, only a week after I began my ministry in Alberni. Danny told me that his best friend had been murdered when they were imprisoned together as children in the United Church's residential school in town. He also said his friend had been buried in the hills behind the still-standing school. As he said, quote, there are lots of kids still in those hills. Well, the more I worked in Port Alberni, the more I began to meet many such witnesses to crime, since I opened the doors of my church to Indians and let them speak from my pulpit. Our congregation tripled in size in a few months, so my parishioners were mostly happy. They were even exhilarated by the changes, and even by the sudden presence of Indians next to them in the pews on Sundays, something unheard of in Port Alberni until then. But there was a rump of six parishioners who were personally connected to men who were later charged with rape and other atrocities in the Alberni Residential School. And that rump of six oppositionists started working to have me removed as minister. It took them 2 years to achieve that, and only because an element in the wider Unite Church leadership sided with them, quite illegally, after I wrote a letter that exposed their complicity in genocide. That letter was dated October 17th, 1994, and it was addressed to the local presbytery leaders. In it, I called on the church to return to the coastal Housed Indians the land wrongfully taken from them by our church missionaries. I cited the standing United Church policy that required that stolen native land in the church's possession had to be returned without conditions to indigenous nations. I was simply asking the church to do the right and the legal thing according to its own stated principles. The local church leaders not only refused to reply to my letter, but they notified the United Church head office in Toronto about what I'd written. Within the same week, United Church moderator Marion Best and General Secretary Virginia Coleman ordered that I be removed from my pulpit and expelled from my livelihood, in other words, defrocked, despite the fact that I had done nothing wrong and was married with two children to support. This rapid and unwarranted attack on me happened because I had stumbled across a big money arrangement involving my church, the provincial government, the multinational logging companies McMillan, Bloedel, and Weyerhaeuser, and even some of the state-funded Ahouset Band Council chiefs. For the land that I referred to in my letter, Lot 363 on the Moctosis Ahouset Reserve, figured centrally in the biggest corporate acquisition in British Columbia history, the buying up of McMillan Bloedel by Weyerhaeuser. The United Church, which was financially endowed by McMillan Bloedel, arranged the land transfer, and one of their own clergymen who was in office, John Kishore, the provincial minister of the environment, he covered up the church's involvement. My letter not only threatened to upset the apple cart, in John Kishore's own words, but it also exposed the United Church as a thief of Ahouset land and a killer of their children. For on the same lot 363 had stood the church's Ahouset Indian Residential School, where more than half the children incarcerated there died between the years 1891 and 1973. Well, sure enough, without cause, notice, or review, I was then summarily fired from my pulpit shortly after I wrote my letter, on January 23, 1995. I was fired by two church officials, Art Anderson and Cameron Reed. My firing had never been voted on or even discussed in the local body of the church, the official body, my employer, the Comox Nanaimo Presbytery. Instead, my firing was decided solely by a handful of unmandated church officials whose meetings were held in camera and without minutes. My firing was a psychological attack from the start, delivered with maximum force and cruelty. My dismissal letter, handed to me by Art Anderson, said that if I didn't agree to a so-called psychiatric evaluation, which the church itself admitted was unwarranted, and a year's pastoral retraining, I think they call that re-education in China, if I didn't agree to those two things, I'd be expelled from United Church ministry. I wasn't allowed to see any evidence prompting my firing, nor could I even face my accusers. Nor were any charges ever brought against me. Eventually, the United Church spent over $300,000 in a public show trial to throw me out of its ranks and rob me and my family of our meal ticket. Astoundingly, they even approached my wife, Anne, soon after I was fired, and offered to pay her and fund her divorce if she left me. Unfortunately, Anne agreed to do so. So, as with any whistleblower who threatens big money, I was targeted for rapid destruction by having the three foundations of my life pulled out from under me: my livelihood and employability, my family, and my public reputation. None of this was accidental or the random acts of seemingly petty men. For my letter about Lot 363 that threatened to expose the crimes of church, state, and big business on the West Coast, that letter was issued just as the first stories of Indian residential school crimes were breaking into the Canadian media in late 1994. In the words of United Church official Brian Thorpe, who engineered my firing and defrocking, quote, "We had no problems with Kevin until he wrote his letter on the Ahouset land. Then something had to be done," unquote. Well, something certainly was done. In just under a year, I was fired, without cause, publicly blackened and made unemployable.
I lost my family and daily access to my children through a church-funded divorce and custody action, and my attempt to professionally retrain at the University of British Columbia was blocked by the United Church. All of this was clearly in response to my threatened exposure of the details of the West Coast genocide and the central role played in it by the Catholic, Anglican, and United Church. Some indication of this is the fact that the United Church formally voted to delist, that is, defrock me, only 2 days after the first class action lawsuit by residential school survivors against the United Church was announced in the Vancouver Sun on February 1, 1996. February 3rd, they decided to move against me. At the time, I was working with many residential school survivors, and I helped to form the first organization of survivors and convene the first public tribunal in Canada into the residential school atrocities. All of that had to stop in the mind of the litigation-afraid United Church and their government and corporate backers. And so, in August of 1996, my formal delisting began at a stage-managed kangaroo court in Vancouver, the only public defrocking of a United Church minister in its entire history. Well, a complete, independent, and accurate account of that hearing is available at the website itccs.org. The entire process was a farce and a miscarriage of justice from start to finish. In the words of one observer, Merva Cottle, quote, "It was nothing more than the public execution of an inconvenient man by an in-house church inquisition, without a trace of fairness or due process. Reverend Annett was expected to comply with his own professional destruction, and he was condemned when he refused to do so." The stated purpose of the delisting hearing was to consider my, quote, suitability for ministry, and to decide whether I would be placed on the discontinued service list of United Church clergy, in other words, thrown out of my profession. But the handful of people running the proceedings were all from the same cozy inside group. The entire proceedings bore the tone and manner of a medieval witch hunt, where the accused is assumed to be guilty and must publicly confess to his wrong. For one thing, the delisting hearing was convened by the very men who had arranged my firing without cause the year before, United Church lawyer John Jessamine and church officials Brian Thorpe and Art Anderson. Jessamine, who had encouraged my dismissal from St. Andrews and then blocked any appeal or resolution of my firing, well, he was the judge at my delisting hearing. The panel of three United Church insiders who would decide whether I would remain a clergyman were all handpicked by Jessamine. The panel chair, Molly Williams, was in fact a personal friend of Jessamine, and with the other panel members often went out to lunch with him during the hearing. No, I kid you not. The prosecuting lawyer, Ian Benson, was a conservative Catholic who had an open and virulent hatred for me, for some reason, since we'd never met. And he was paid over $50,000 by the church to prove that I was an unworthy minister, which of course he never did prove. And while Benson was a professionally trained lawyer, and along with Jessamine and the panel members, was handsomely paid for every moment at the hearing, I had no legal representation. I appeared voluntarily and on an unpaid basis at my own expense throughout the entire hearing. At the same time, I was also immersed in a divorce and custody battle with my church-funded wife Anne. And that, of course, happening at the same time was no coincidence. The delisting hearing had the semblance of a court of law, but it operated according to the self-governing internal rules of a United Church disciplinary hearing. Even though I was repeatedly told I was not under any discipline, I had committed no offense, and I faced no charges. In the words of one observer, Glenda Lesnov, who was present for the entire hearing, quote, "The whole thing was absurd to watch. It had the pretense, but not the content of a civil court. It was mostly a failed attempt at cosmetics," unquote. On the first day of the hearing, it was stated on the record that I was not to be given any of the evidence that caused my firing, nor was I to be told the rules of procedure that would govern the hearing, or even what criteria governed the delisting of a minister. That would all be decided at the end of the hearing, stated panel chair Molly Williams. Well, clearly, I was thereby being denied due process and the right to prepare any kind of proper defense. Now, according to Beth Johnson, who was mayor of Delta at the time, and who also observed these events, quote, I was astonished the Reverend Annett's request to know the grounds for delisting a minister or the operating rules of the hearing were ruled to be out of order. Such a request is normal in any proper court and according to due process and the rules of evidence. It became clear to me quickly and from the start that the proceedings were not operating according to any fair or responsible system of justice. Reverend Annett had already been found guilty and was there simply to be publicly defamed and castigated by an official church body. Unquote. Well, Mayor Johnson was one of 22 people who wrote protest letters about the hearing to the Attorney General of British Columbia, Ujjal Dosanjh, in the course of my delisting. Dosanjh was a government cabinet colleague of John Kishore, who had engineered my firing. And so, perhaps not surprisingly, eventually Dosanjh replied and stated the following, quote, as part of his letter, quote, the internal procedures of the United Church are outside the jurisdiction of this department, unquote. Outside the jurisdiction of the Attorney General, that is, outside the law of the land. The government thereby declared that the United Church of Canada was a law unto itself and could do whatever it wanted to me or to anyone else in its ranks, including, as we know, even kill thousands of Aboriginal children and legally exonerate themselves for the crime. I was simply the church's latest target. Well, none of the so-called witnesses who were called against me during the hearing had ever seen me in action as a minister or even heard me preach, nor had they even visited Port Alberni. And yet they passed judgment on me based on what they had heard about me. Hearsay evidence. Well, according to the panel's own rules of procedure, that kind of hearsay was specifically excluded as evidence. However, the panel and Justman continually ignored their own rules at whim and allowed such rumor and innuendo to stand, and continually ruled every time against me every time I objected. Similarly, all of the unsolicited 38 letters of support for me from my parishioners and others in Port Alberni that I had entered as evidence to testify to my credibility as a minister, all 38 letters were excluded from the panel's final report. But on the other hand, the four letters that were included in that report were all written by inside church officials who had no first-hand knowledge of me and some of whom I had never met. All four of those letters that were never seen by me were introduced secretly to the hearing during my absence. Those four letters, fraudulent letters, were the basis of the panel's eventual decision to rule against me. The church's original plan was to defrock me in 2 or 3 days. In fact, it took them nearly 6 months to do so because I kept challenging the fraudulent proceedings and cross-examining the four church officials who were called by the church's lawyer to testify against me. In the course of that cross-examination, those pathetic functionaries made a lot of gaffes and fatal admissions. For example, the chairman of Comox Nanaimo Presbytery, Bob Stiven, revealed the campaign of racist prejudice and fear waged against me when he stated, quote, Kevin wasn't called to minister to Indians. He was supposed to minister to the gray-haired English grannies who make up our church. He had no place among us when he started talking about missing Indian children in residential schools. In my rage about all that, I can't say that he got a fair hearing, unquote. Stiven's colleague, Wynne Stokes, exploded an even bigger secret on the witness stand when he declared, a senior government official told me that we couldn't let Kevin upset the apple cart over the Lot 363 deal. There was too much at stake. Unquote. Quite an admission. And yet this obvious reference to a criminal conspiracy to silence me and bury a crime was excluded from the hearing's record by Mr. Jessaman, as was any reference to Aboriginal people, the Yahousa land deal, and residential schools. Well, I immediately challenged Jessaman on the absurdity of his excluding such references, since Native people and their land had been an integral part of my Alberni ministry and were at the heart of why I was fired after I wrote my letter on Lot 363. After my challenge, the hammer came down. Judge Jessaman ordered the hearing stenographic reporter to leave the room, and he declared the sessions now in camera without a written record. He also threatened to ban all the observers from the hearing if they tried communicating with me or record what was being said. When I asked Jessaman on what grounds he was trying to suspend our civil liberties, he replied, this is an ecclesiastical court and has its own special procedures. Oh, you mean this is an inquisition? I replied. He didn't answer me. The next day, after Jennifer Wade had alerted the Globe and Mail newspaper and McLean's magazine about the farcical proceedings going on, and they dispatched reporters to cover the hearing, Judge Jessamine relented and called back the court reporter. As the hearing progressed, the so-called witnesses called against me proved by their own statements that there were no grounds for the church's claim that I was an unfit minister. They also showed how I had been railroaded out of my pulpit in contravention of United Church policies governing the removal of a minister. This is obvious by looking at the transcripts of the hearing, which were recorded independently by observers who were present. For example, it was admitted by Presbytery official Wynne Stokes that no vote had ever been taken in the Comox Nanaimo Presbytery to remove me from my pulpit. My firing was orchestrated by some executive members acting alone and without directions from the presbytery at large. According to the transcript, September 12, 1996, 9:31 a.m. Annette, was there at any time a debate in presbytery about my removal from my pulpit? Stokes, no. Annette, was it put to a vote? Stokes, no. Annette, so there was nowhere that I or another member of Presbytery could go to address the issue? Stokes, not directly, no. Well, similarly, no charges were ever brought against me by Presbytery. From the same statement by Wynne Stokes at 1:37 p.m. that same day, Stokes, I was assured by Mr. Thorpe that all our meetings would be guided by natural justice. Annette, but how could they have been when I was never told what the charges were against me or why I was fired? Lawyer and Benson interrupting, this statement by Reverend Annette is entirely a fabrication. These are all old questions. There were no charges against him. There are none. Why does he keep asking those questions? Annette, if I can continue, please. Wynne, do you know of any charges against me? Stokes, no, there were none. Finally, after the fact, the United Church claimed I was fired because I hadn't recognized the authority of the church. In reality, I'd invited Presbytery to mediate conflicts in my church, and I had negotiated in good faith with its committee after my firing. From Stokes' same testimony at 10:38 a.m., Stokes, a lot of work went into coming to a tentative agreement with you after February. Annette, so it's true that I negotiated in good faith. Stokes, oh yes, that was never in question. Annette, and it was me who had invited Presbytery to intervene in my congregation for pastoral oversight when the dispute first arose in December. Stokes, yes, that's accurate. And here's the rub. In fact, by the admission of these very Presbytery officials, it was not my competence or integrity as a minister that was an issue to them and that it provoked the delisting trial, but rather, the issue was that I had written a letter to them objecting to the United Church's sale of Lot 363 on the Hazard Reserve to the church's business partner, the logging company McMillan Blodell. After submitting that letter, I was targeted for removal and defrocking by the highest officials of the United Church under the direction of British Columbia Government Minister John Kishore and his corporate associates. Clearly, the evidence indicated that the issue of my suitability for ministry was a red herring and a mere smokescreen to conceal the fact that I had been the target of a criminal conspiracy by the church, the government, and business involving Aboriginal land theft and genocide. Well, as this fact became apparent to everyone in the hearing, John Jessamine and the panel members became openly desperate and grossly unethical. On October 7th, over a month into the hearing, I pressed Presbytery official Bob Stiven about the church's cover-up of its Lot 363 land sale. According to the transcript, Annette, I need to clarify a few things. You and Wynne have both said that the National Church is responsible for native land claims. Stiven, it's your ministry that's the issue here, not land claims. Annette, so why did our presbytery table a report from Oliver Howard about the Lot 363 negotiations? Stiven, what report? Annette, at the October 1994 presbytery meeting in Gold River. I was there, so were you. Do you remember his report? Stiven, no. Annette, Oliver Howard told me that he met with you as presbytery chairman and he told you all about the report. Stiven, no, he never did. Annette, so why would Oliver lie? Stiven, I'm not going there. Annette, Bob, in his report, Oliver claimed that the Ahouse chiefs wouldn't meet with us, but they say the opposite. They say the land was never ours to sell, that our church stole it from them. Lawyer Ian Benson interrupting, Madam Chair, we've heard enough here. Annette, Bob, our land claims policy says we can't hold on to stolen Aboriginal land. That's all that I wrote about in my letter. John Jessamine, interrupting. I believe this cross-examination is complete. I so order. At this point, after shutting down my examination of Stiven on Lot 363, John Jessamine declared a 15-minute recess. And Jessamine, Lawyer Benson, and the panel members gathered separately and consulted one another in an adjoining room. In other words, the judge, the prosecuting attorney, and the jury all left and talked. This itself was a clear breach of courtroom protocol and rules of procedure, and normally would have nullified the proceedings in any genuine court of law. And yet Jennifer Wade, who witnessed the entire hearing, remarked, quote, "That was the norm. I regularly witnessed Jessamine, Benson, and the entire panel, and even some of the witnesses meeting separately, going to lunch together, laughing and exchanging pleasantries in the church lobby." When did the judge, prosecutor, and jury get to do that? Unquote. Upon the panel's return, Jessamine announced that any references made to Lot 363 or Aboriginal people would be stricken from the hearing's record. During the subsequent Christmas break, Reverend Bruce Gunn from Ahouset shared with me a letter that finally revealed the details of the conspiracy to remove me from ministry, a conspiracy headed by Brian Thorpe, who had organized the delisting hearing and was due to be called as a witness against me. These revelations were contained in the following statement that Bruce Gunn attempted unsuccessfully to have included in the hearing's official record. December 20th, 1996. After Kevin Annett wrote his letter of concern about our church's sale of a house at land lot 363 to non-native associates of our church, I intended to show a copy of his letter to United Church moderator Marion Best within a week of its submission to Comox Nanaimo Presbytery Executive. This would have been at a meeting of the World Mission Division in Toronto on the first weekend of November 1994, chaired by Rhea Whitehead. Before I could do so, Marion Best approached me with a copy of Kevin's letter in her hand. She looked very concerned, and she asked me if I knew about the letter. I said I did, and her look said it all. That same week, she had put John Siebert from the National Office on the case. Over the next few months, it was Siebert and Brian Thorpe who set about to neutralize Kevin and get the Ahouset chiefs on side. They did so by going to Ahouset and paying off the chiefs with a $14,000 bribe, $7,000 directly to them, and then by picking up a $7,000 tab for research into their land claims. These same chiefs later were encouraged to disassociate themselves from Kevin. The money was transmitted to the Ahouset chiefs through the United Church's Northern Native Group, led by Alvin Dixon. I believe Kevin's removal originated from the church's head office. The church knew that over 1,400 lawsuits were coming down the pipe over the residential schools. The fact that Marion Best sent Siebert and Thorpe to buy off the chiefs and rally them against Kevin was confirmed in person to me recently at a secret meeting of the chiefs with the church head officers, including the moderator Marion Best. The meeting happened at Kevin's former church, St. Andrew's in Port Alberni, where Kathleen Hogman had taken over. It was in early May of this year, 1996. I was asked to attend the meeting. Virginia Coleman, the National Secretary, plus Marion Best, was there. From the Native side were Nelson Keedla, Ron Hamilton, and Charlie Thompson from the New Chalmouth Tribal Council, and some of the Ahouset chiefs like the Edgars and the Atleos. At the meeting, I heard Virginia Coleman, speaking for the entire church, make an offer to the chiefs, saying the church would grant limited compensation to some of the Port Alberni residential school survivors, but only on two conditions, that the chiefs publicly disassociate themselves from Kevin Annett, and that they never support any investigation into the deaths of children in the residential schools. The chiefs all agreed to this deal. This agreement and the actions of the highest United Church officers is, I believe, responsible for all of the church's actions against Reverend Anna to date, including this present delisting hearing. The issue before us is therefore not one of Kevin's suitability for ministry, which has been amply proven, but rather the church's efforts to silence an inconvenient whistleblower. I want to add that the man who removed Kevin from his pulpit, the personnel officer for BC Conference, Art Anderson, came up to me at a gathering in Kelowna in the summer of 1995, soon after he had helped stop the negotiations between Kevin and Presbytery, and he said, "Bruce, if you have any pull with Kevin, tell him he'll never work in this province again if he doesn't play ball with us. No one will ever hire him after he's been defrocked." These facts convince me that from the start to finish, Reverend Kevin Annett has been the target of a definite conspiracy, and that this present hearing is merely the final stage in this deliberate professional and public destruction of him by the United Church of Canada and its top officers. Signed, Reverend Bruce W. M. Gunn. Bruce Gunn attempted to read this statement into the hearing's record during the subsequent hearing session on February 6, 1997, but he was prevented from doing so by Judge Jessamine. I then moved that the panel members step down on the grounds that the hearing proceedings were flawed and prejudicial. Panel Chair Molly Williams quickly denied my motion. Despite the fact that Brian Thorpe, who'd arranged the hearing, had actively conspired to expel me from United Church ministry and cover up the Lot 363 deal, Thorpe was called by Ian Benson as an expert witness against me during the opening sessions in 1997. And yet Thorpe admitted that he had never seen me preach a sermon or conduct man ministry, and had never even been in Port Alberni during my time there. On the final day of Thorpe's testimony, Bruce Gunn, on behalf of me, asked Thorpe if he remembered the offer he had made to Thorpe in February of 95 to intervene as a mediator after I was fired. According to the transcript, it ran as follows. Thorpe: yes, I recall something about that. Gunn: I told you over the phone that Kevin wanted to resolve the situation, but that he wouldn't agree to a psychiatric exam, which was unwarranted. Thorpe: that's correct. There was no basis for the presbytery to request a psychiatric assessment. Gunn: no basis. And yet that was the one and only issue preventing a resolution. So why did presbytery stand firm on that demand? Thorpe: I can't answer that. Gunn: but Bob Stiven told me that presbytery was taking directions from you. Thorpe: no, I was simply the administrator. Gunn: you're the chief executive officer for the United Church in BC. Are you the person who prevented a resolution? Thorpe: no. Jessamine, interrupting: I believe this line of questioning is not relevant. Judge Jessamine's interruption is significant, since he was protecting himself and his own prejudicial role in my firing. For subsequently, introduced inadvertently by lawyer Ian Benson, was evidence that indicated that it was John Jessamine himself who had halted all negotiations between Comox and Nanaimo Presbytery and me, and prevented a resolution in early June of 1995. Ian Benson stated on the record that Art Anderson, the personnel officer for the conference office who had removed me from my pulpit, had received a letter from John Jessamine, the panel's presiding judicial officer, John Jessamine acting at the time as legal counsel for the United Church. This letter, dated June 6, 1995, had Jessamine advising Anderson to inform Presbytery to break off all negotiations with me, despite the fact that Presbytery was on the verge of concluding an agreement with me that would have allowed me to retain my standing as a minister. In effect, and here's the rub, the church's own counsel had admitted that an agreement with me had been deliberately sabotaged by the presiding judge, John Jessamine, preventing a peaceful resolution between me and the church and forcing the delisting trial. Upon hearing this, I made a motion that John Jessamine immediately step down as a judicial officer for the panel on the grounds of a perceived bias and conflict of interest on his part. The panel, on Jessamine's advice, adjourned to consider the motion. The panel did not reconvene for another month, not until March 6, 1997. Panel Chair Molly Williams opened the session by reading a prepared statement that denied my request. Denied the request, of course. And declared that the proceedings would continue. After expressing complete confidence in Jessamine's neutrality and integrity. Well, at this point, I asked for a recess to confer with my advisors. Upon reconvening, I asked Bruce Gunn to read a statement to the panel on my behalf. And the statement read in part, quote, in light of the panel's denial of our motion to have Mr. Jessamine step down as judge of these proceedings, since he's clearly in a grave and obvious conflict of interest, I have no choice but to withdraw from these proceedings because further participation in them may compromise any future legal action by me against the United Church. I do not want to appear complicit in or in agreement with the fraudulent, unfair, and biased nature of these proceedings. Under legal advice, I remove myself from this hearing and will appeal its procedures to a civil court. And then Bruce Gunn and I, along with most of the observers, got up and left the hearing. As we were exiting the church hall, the panel chair, Molly Williams, yelled out very loudly and irately, quote, "Bruce and Kevin, if you leave this hearing now, you'll both face dire consequences." Unfortunately, the travesty in Forest continued. To the disbelief of several of the observers who remained, the delisting panel continued its proceedings without me present. After our departure, Judge Desmond then informed the panel that he was exercising his authority to continue the proceedings under executive order of the General Council of the United Church of Canada, its top body. Church Counsel Ian Benson then asked the panel for permission to read into the hearing's record letters against me, which, as it turned out, had been solicited in the course of the hearing and were never shown to me, something strictly forbidden under natural justice and legal rules of procedure. Four letters were entered into the panel's record, and three of them were obtained from United Church officials in Toronto. All of these officials, Paul Webb, Paul Mills, and Linda Davidson, had previously been named by me as having aided and abetted criminal activity at the Fred Victor United Church Mission in Toronto, where I had served as its chaplain during 1991 and 92. These crimes by the three I named included documented drug trafficking, prostitution, financial embezzlement, and other felonies that involved church personnel, including the three of them. Paul Mills, one of the three, and a church lawyer, had stated to me shortly before my firing from Fred Victor without cause, quote, "We know all about those things, Kevin. The only problem here is that you wrote a letter about it," unquote. Fred Victor Mission was the subject of a subsequent police investigation in Toronto, and a successful lawsuit brought by Mission residents against the United Church of Canada in the Supreme Court of Ontario, in which these allegations of criminal acts were proven and the church was found guilty. In the course of that lawsuit, and subsequently, one of the Mission residents and plaintiffs in that lawsuit, Mike Waffle, informed me that, quote, "You were targeted by Webb, Mills, and Davidson after you blew the whistle on their shady operations. They circulated lies about you and said you were stealing funds from the mission. Then they spread that all over the United Church," unquote. Yet those were the three church officials whose letters had been obtained by Lawyer Benson in the course of my delisting hearing and were entered into the hearing's official record as bona fide evidence, despite the wrongful manner of their solicitation and the clearly biased agenda of their authors toward me. But on the basis of those letters, the panel was instructed by Judge Jessamine to conclude their proceedings and render a verdict against me. The hearing was officially closed the same day on March 6, 1997. Well, the next day, the panel wrote me a letter that informed me that I was officially expelled from United Church ministry and placed on its discontinued service list of ministers. Its decision was final and could not be appealed. The letter was transmitted by a G.R. Schmidt for the Vancouver law firm of Ferguson Gifford that was acting for the United Church. In a separate letter, I was instructed by Schmidt on behalf of the United Church not to divulge or discuss any of the events of the delisting hearing or the issues of persons named or any matter involving the United Church's dealings with Native people, its residential schools, or land transactions. If I didn't comply with these instructions, the letter stated, I would face possible legal action. Well, I ignored this letter, and I've spoken publicly on many occasions since then about the delisting hearing, and yet I've never faced legal action for doing so by the United Church or anyone else. During that same week of March 7th to 12th, 1997, the delisting panel's final report on me was placed on the national website of the United Church of Canada. The report is unrepresentative of the events of the hearing and is a deliberate falsification, not only of the panel proceedings, but of me and my ministry. And yet the so-called report still stands as the United Church's official account of its delisting proceedings against Kevin Annett and his work and ministry. Its falsehoods have been disseminated to the media and to the public for over 20 years now, to the continued ruination of my public name, reputation, and employability. So in conclusion, what does this all mean? Well, it should be obvious to many of us by now that any big corporation with enough money and legal protection has the capacity to destroy the lives of anyone it likes with impunity and immunity. I've personally experienced such an assault, and I've never really recovered from it. Because in my case, the big organization was a national church that historically led the drive in our country to exterminate Indigenous nations and seize their lands, and that has the full protection of the Canadian state. The United Church, along with the Anglicans and the Catholics, killed more than 60,000 Aboriginal children and got away with this crime against humanity with a few words of apology. So naturally, destroying my livelihood, family, and good name, and wiping me out with a fraudulent kangaroo court hearing was a mere trifle for them. What I found more baffling, and that's caused me to completely rethink my view of Canada and my place within it, is the extent to which no one has dared to lift a finger to challenge or stop these crimes, and how everything in Canada operates to protect and maintain such institutionalized criminality. If the scales have finally fallen from my eyes, it's only because they were blown off by persecution and terror at the hands of both Canadian church and state. Only a culture that's approaching spiritual death, and is perhaps already there, allows such things to happen. We're not the people who we thought we were. Who we might become is still in doubt. All that we do know is that we can no longer hold to, and we must discard, the false narrative of a benevolent Canada, and rather look to ourselves in the mirror that some of us have held up to the nation through our sacrifices. And for that reason, none of us have the excuse of ignorance anymore. Even if you do not know of these horrible facts and did not know of them before I shared them with you today, let's remember that under the law, ignorance of a crime is no defense. Your tax money, your church tithing, and your silence go towards concealing and continuing crimes against the innocent. Objectively, that fact makes all of us complicit in Christian Canada's oldest and ongoing crime. But there is a way out of such complicity, a long and a hard way, but a redeeming one. I have learned this only through my own suffering and loss, and that of many others. Perhaps some of you will also have the fortune to undergo such a liberating catharsis, so that complicity can give way to a new society and to actual justice. In the meantime, there are moral and legal obligations we all have that are required by our knowledge of a crime, beginning with the need to not cooperate with it anymore. Under international law, no one can contribute money to the United Anglican or Catholic churches without becoming an accessory to a criminal body. Nor can those murderous churches enjoy tax exemptions under Canadian law without the government itself becoming yet again an accomplice with them. Only a bottom-up national house cleaning can begin to undo our genocidal legacy and the stain that continues to spread from it. A cleansing that can begin with an international war crimes trial that puts the fiduciary heads of church, state, and corporations on trial for genocide. Perhaps that's all imaginary thinking. Throughout history, no victorious nation or church has ever tried and condemned itself for its own domestic war crimes. Canada's ongoing denial and institutionalized cover-up of the full truth of Aboriginal genocide is as serious a crime as the genocide itself. But at least we don't have to associate with those crimes anymore. That may be our only possibility for redemption, if there is any to be found at all. I thank you.
Sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I.